Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Suzanne Youngerman, and I'm Director of the Department of Education and Humanities here at BAM. And it's my great pleasure and a privilege to welcome all of you to tonight's Eat, Drink, and Be Literary on behalf of Karen Brooks Hopkins, who's the president of BAM, and Joseph Melillo, who is the executive producer, and all of us at BAM. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce Harold Augenbrauer. He's the executive director of our great partner in this program, the National Book Foundation, the National Book Awards. And he'll say a little bit about the program and introduce our featured guests this evening. So thank you and enjoy.
Thank you, Suzanne. I want to thank everybody for coming tonight. It's a little bit warmer this week than it was last week when I suggested that everybody vacate the place and move to Florida. I'm very pleased to welcome you here on behalf of the National Book Foundation. I'm really the literary warm-up more than anything else. We sort of move from performance to literature when I take the stage. It's our great pleasure to co-sponsor this with BAM. We've co-sponsored it for 4 years. Last week I talked a little bit about the end of the Bush era, and the politics of literature in the ending of the Bush era, and how, as they left the White House, they came out with a report saying that during the Bush era, reading, literary reading, had risen immeasurably during those 6 years. I then subsequently read this article, I don't know if those of you have seen it, by, was it Karl Rove, talking about how many books George Bush reads every year, and it was something like 65 2 years ago and 40 last year. And I guess if you believe that, that's we need a new acronym for weapons of mass destruction. But I think what to sort of bring you into the new era that started just the other day with miswording of the political spectrum, one of the, what is Obama, the oath of office, to sort of bring in the beginning of the Obama era, one of the things that I got as the director of the National Book Foundation over the last couple of days was a lot of people suggesting to me that I contact the Obama White House and that we have every week we have a little entry on our website that says what Barack Obama is reading this week. Now, I wish I could do that, but I don't really know Barack Obama or Rahm Emanuel. So what I'm asking you is that if you know Barack Obama, if you would come up to me afterwards, and I'll ask you to contact him on our behalf, and then with his BlackBerry, which, as you saw in the paper today, he refuses to give up, he will send me an email saying, "Dear Harold, this is what I'm reading this week. Love, Barry." Anyway, it's my great pleasure to introduce the program this evening. This is how it's going to go. I'm going to introduce the moderator for the evening. He is then going to introduce the writer for the evening. Nathan will read for about 12, 14 minutes. They will then get off the stage. The technical personnel from BAM will come up, set the stage for the conversation. Dan and Nathan will come back up. They'll sit down, have a conversation for about 15 minutes. Then we'll open it up to the audience. So start thinking about your questions now. After that, Nathan will be signing his books at the back of the room. So if there are no questions from me, I will go into the program. Let me introduce Dan Menaker. Dan is what used to be called a man of letters. And he is, that's an old-fashioned term, but Dan has reinvented himself for the new century. Dan succeeded William Maxwell, that great revered William Maxwell, whose 100th birthday was last year, at the New Yorker as a fiction editor, and as such had enormous influence on American literary tastes. In 2001, he became executive editor at Random House and then editor-in-chief of the Random House Publishing Group. He's the author of 2 books of short stories and the novel The Treatment, which was made into a film a couple of years ago, a really good film a couple of years ago, starring Stephanie March and Ian Holm and Chris Eigenman. He's currently working on a nonfiction book, which I think will be published sometime in 2010. And he is also the host of the internet book program Title Page. The first time Dan and I worked together was about 12 years ago. We put together a series of programs on The New Yorker to celebrate The New Yorker. I think it was in 1996, and we did four panel discussions on fiction, nonfiction, sort of overall in the history of The New Yorker, and the comics one, which was absolutely hilarious, with Bob Mankoff, if everybody knows sort of the wild man, Bob Mankoff. It was a standing room only thing. We had a great time putting it together, and we had wonderful people there, and it was a lot of fun. Standing room only audiences at every one. He also worked with us at the National Book Foundation on the William Maxwell Centennial this past summer that we presented. And so it gives me great pleasure to work with him again and great pleasure to introduce him tonight. Dan Menneker.
Thank you, Harold. It's a great honor and pleasure to be here. This program is one of the sort of cynosures of literary New York. In its 5 years, I think it has taken its place among the most important and sociable literary events of our entire city. And I'm very honored to work with BAM and to work with the National Book Foundation. It's my just as great a pleasure, if perhaps not greater pleasure, since I admire wonderful writers so much, to introduce Nathan Englander to you. I think you all know who he is. I'm going to read from the program because he says it's better than Wikipedia. He says that someone keeps fooling around with his Wikipedia entry, and I had his Wikipedia entry all ready to go, but now I'm too nervous to read it because I don't know what it will falsify. Maybe he's not Jewish. I don't know. Hard to say, but after I read this thing that you can read for yourself, I will amplify for about one more minute, and then he'll come up and do a reading for you. Then we'll talk for 15 or 20 minutes, and then you'll ask questions, I hope. Nathan Englander was born in New York in 1970. His short fiction has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and numerous anthologies, including The Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Prize Anthology, and the Pushcart Prize. Englander's story, a collection, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, which was published by Knopf in 1999, earned him a Penn Malamud Award and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Sue Kaufman Prize. His novel, The Ministry of Special Cases, also published, I believe, in 2007 by Knopf, earned him, well, his career has earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2003, and he's been a fellow more recently at the Dorothy and Lewis B. Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. He lives in Manhattan. It turns out that almost everyone sitting at our table lives in the same neighborhood, and so we were talking about delis for some time before. I just want to say that she's going to read, I believe, from his novel, The Ministry of Special Cases, and his writing, both in his collection of stories and in his novel, is an odd kind of original and very surprising fiction. It, as I said, it mainly talks about people in terrible pickles of one kind or another, and they remind us, even though they're different and special, they may be in Argentina, they may be in Stalinist Russia, they are, to me, deeply intensified versions of some pickles that we all face of a deep moral and social and political kind. I've admired his work ever since I started reading it, and it's a great honor to introduce him. Nathan Englander.
They're always lowering microphones for me. One day it'll get lifted when I read with Dr. Ruth or something like that. Anyway, thank you for that generous introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. This is just a warm room in advance. I guess we'll talk after about Wikipedia and other such things, but I'm going to read to you from the novel, as promised. It's chapter 6. I'll try to do this briefly. I start talking and suddenly it's about, I don't know, I'm off on physics and it's 47 minutes later and I forget to say the main characters, even though this is my 900th event. There are four people in this book, basically. Three. A mother, a father, and a son. It's set in Argentina during the Dirty War, 1976. I'm going to read you the coup chapter. Actually, and the coup, it would have saved me, this book took me 300 or 400 years to write. It would have saved me at least a decade had I started with the coup. But and we talk about actually a nice transfer of power. But I sort of become obsessed with hindsight and how history works and how we treat everything as inevitable. And so little is inevitable. It takes sort of an active looking away for things to happen. But we say March 23rd, 1976, there was a coup in Argentina. But it was so long building. And, you know, what it takes, people were already disappearing. They were already disappearing with Isabelita. And, it was something, it took an active communal looking away for this to happen. And I got obsessed about, you know, these moments where, again, it's only with true vigilance that you can discuss inevitability, and here I am off. But I started this book, the first few years of it, I wrote in Jerusalem, and that's where I became obsessed with this idea where everything was delivered to us as if it had to be, and I saw, you know, it doesn't have to be. You know, we can all, anyway, it's a time of hope. We'll skip that. It's honestly, it's really strange to re-enter this book. You know, for all these years, I thought I was going to spend all this time defending it, as this is not, you know, a thinly veiled metaphor. You know, because the main metaphor of this book also is habeas corpus, a country that suspends habeas corpus, which to me, when I dreamed, you know, started thinking about it in the middle 90s, to me it was just a sign of a country gone awry. To me, there is no greater signal of a country out of control than the suspension of habeas corpus. And at some point in the writing, the metaphor cracked its boundaries and it became a reality. I became one of these people that I'm obsessed with that goes about his business. You know, there I am on book tour for a year and a half trying to sell books when I should be burning cars in the streets. You know, to me, honestly, it was sort of a shock. But here we are, and Guantanamo is going to close. That's a big one. That is a big one. Anyway, so yeah, so Kaddish is the father, Lillian is the mother, and their son, Pato, is he's 19, which is a full-time job. Lillian works in insurance, and Kaddish, which we'll also talk about, works in a cemetery, which is too hard to explain. Here goes. As four men from the Navy threw a career Army man from the window, he was thinking his last thoughts. A retired colonel, his uniform covered in the ribbons and medals of a military regime, all those decorations were upended along with him as the blood rushed to his head. A medal came loose and clanked against the street. A chest full of honors, and what good did it do him? I should have served in the Air Force, he thought. Then I would have wings. With that, not even the time for a cynical upturn of the lips, he hit the avenue of the Liberator, and along with the countless motions that make up a late night in Buenos Aires that together are the heartbeat of any city in the world, Lillian Poznan turned her head on the pillow to have her last deep sleep before her fears turned real. Lillian didn't feel the city was light one resident when she woke up. She didn't feel, as she often did in the kitchen with her bills, that the country was united in spinning out of control. Looking into the street, she didn't sense that there were right then a million more working stiffs in front of a million more windows, all in it together, all but the colonel, his window still open, a cat curled up on its ledge. Lillian had slept well. She'd woken up rested to find that Kaddish still hadn't come home, and miracle of miracles, Pato had already left for school. She took her time getting ready. El Golpe, the Sting, played on the radio, and she tried to remember what theater she saw the movie in. She stood in her stockings eating a pastry over the sink as she decided on the beta on La Vache. Lillian waited for the old cage elevator that ran up the center of their building like a spine, the staircase snaking around it. She waited with a hand on the gate, one knee locked and one knee bent to compensate for the weight of her briefcase. The door to Cacho's apartment opened. Her neighbor was still in his pajamas and had a worried look on his face. He scratched furiously at one of his eyebrows, and because of this, Lillian noticed that the other one was chapped and red. He was an early riser, a militant in his lifestyle. She'd never before seen Cacho in his bedclothes, never with a wrinkle in his shirt, even at the end of the day. She'd always felt he must keep an iron at the office hidden in his desk. You home from work today, Cacho? Work today, he said, and went back to scratching. Work today, he repeated, standing up on his tiptoes to look behind Lillian and keeping an eye on the stairs. That's when the question turned entertaining, the best thing he'd heard in a while. Cacho gave a quick laugh. Work today, would you? Obviously, Lillian said, and held up her briefcase heavy with files. It's rhetorical, Cacho said, almost screaming. The question is, would you go to work if you were me? Would you go out this morning if you were me? Lillian had never seen Cacho like this, and waiting for an answer to his rhetorical question, he switched to the other eyebrow, and she saw that on the first there was blood. He had scratched himself bloody. If you were in my position, would you even leave the house today? I don't know, Lillian said. What's your position? What does it matter? You're already in it, and still you go. With this, he dropped his hand from his eyebrow, only to throw both arms up in frustration. He retreated into the apartment and slammed the door. Lillian was so intrigued by this, she didn't notice for another couple of minutes that the elevator was out again. She had slept well. She was happy and took the stairs. It wasn't long before Lillian understood the position she and Cacho were in, the one Cottage and Pato were in, the position they all were in, especially, but not really any more especially, that their leader Isabelita was in or already out of that morning. Lillian was walking down Avenida de Macho toward the pink house and the plaza in front of it, the route she took every day. Except there was a roadblock up ahead, and beyond that a tank in the middle of the city. It was preposterous, and Lillian looked to her right and her left to see if there was anyone to share this with. She saw a man going the other way who would not make eye contact, and then in an empty parking lot a little way down, she spotted a Dodge pickup. In it were 8 soldiers in uniform, in helmets even, crouched down, covering the directions of the compass. 3 were facing her from the back end where Dodge was stamped in large letters and a pickaxe mounted across the name. The muzzles of the boys' machine guns stuck out over the truck's rear. Lillian looked behind her for the war, for the onslaught, and then again at these young boys, the kind that came knocking on the door for Pato and then slunk off with him, record albums in a stack under their arms. These boys were neat or short-haired, and they were crouched down, guns at the ready. A flatbed truck with a tank on its back crawled across the next avenue. Another one followed behind. These trucks, moving through the city at a speed fit only for funeral processions, lumbering along. Where is the surprise at this speed? Trouble does not break out anywhere in the world, Lillian thought. War is not unleashed. It is slowly, it is carefully installed. Lillian looked toward her neat little soldiers in their parking space. It's almost as if there should have been something to say. If they were not pointing guns, that is, if they were not in the military, she'd have said, there are tanks up ahead. But they probably knew that, could see them just as well as she did. Lillian turned around and went back to the last corner and took a different way to work. It seemed they were having a coup. It seemed they were having a coup, and for this, Cacho stayed home to scratch out his eyes. Frida was at her desk when Lillian walked in. She said before anything, Isabelita is trapped in the pink house. It'll be over before it starts. A day at the most, Gustavo was saying, we're going back to a military government. You'd think they'd have come home, Lillian said. Kaddish was gone and Pato off to university before I got up. Classes must be canceled. Where would the kids go? Lillian shook her head. When do I ever sleep late? Adaptability, Gustavo said. He was out of his office and inserting himself into the conversation as if Lillian had been talking to him. It was Gustavo's way of being boss, of owning everything there. He stood between them and smoothed down his hair. We have inbred ourselves into supreme adaptability, and now it's become a detriment. We'll get used to this government, same as the last, and if it turns on us, we won't even see it coming. We'll go down thinking all is well. Gustavo said this as if the 3 of them were observing it from Switzerland. He spoke with a certain glee. Lillian nodded a thank you and turned back to him and said very clearly to Frida alone, a truck full of men point their guns at me, and still I go on my way. Gustavo circled round and returned himself to the conversation. After the soldiers, who else should come to work more than you? We sell insurance. Today is what we're about. It's our big gamble. We pay out, others pay in. And, Frida said, dragging out the word, life, property, all the values shift. You'll see when things settle. Much will have become precious, and many will have no worth at all. Frida gave up. She'd asked for the advice he'd dispense regardless. So then what do? Sit here and wait? We get down to business, Gustavo said. Life and death you can't control now. It is only profit that can be arranged absolutely during a war. Who are we having a war with? Frida said. That's the point. Figure out the sides and begin to earn. With that, Gustavo went back into his office. Lillian took Frida's hands. You'd think Pato, he's very sensitive. You'd think he'd have turned back from school. A glass floated above the floor, held steady by five fingers pressed from above around the rim. The fingers were of a hand, the hand of an arm, and the arm hung disembodied behind the back of the couch. Lillian dropped her keys on the little antique shelf. She dropped her purse loudly by the wall underneath. The glass held steady. The arm did not move. The television visible beyond the couch showed the Liberator's Cup, River Plate versus Portuguesa. The little men ran back and forth. Lillian couldn't see the ball through the smoke, a thin gray cloud in front of the black and white of the set. Lillian approached, leaning over and kissing Kaddish on the head. He put his cigarette in the ashtray resting on his stomach and placed the glass on his chest. "I'll know you're dead," she said, "if I ever come home and find that cloud missing or that glass knocked over on the floor." "What's wrong with ritual?" Kaddish said. "It doesn't hurt for some things to stay the same." "No," Lillian said. She agreed. Kata sat up with his back against the arm of the couch, his legs stretched out. He moved the ashtray to the floor. "Crazy day," he said. "Very crazy." Lillian smiled and went to sit. Kaddish raised his legs and Lillian slipped in underneath and patted them down. She closed her eyes and let herself relax. She listened for the music that was always on and always too loud, emanating from Pato's room. Lillian couldn't hear it, and that only meant headphones or grinding needle when the boy passed out. Creatures of habit, her husband and her son. They shared a great love for the comfort of sameness. "He asleep?" Lillian said. "Out," Kaddish said. With a tilt of her head, screwing up her face, she stared hard at her husband, trying to understand. She stared hard at her husband and was already mad at herself. On coup day, on this day, how would she not race straight for his room to check? Then there was Kaddish, this man who understood nothing, whom she could not, for a few hours, trust. "Out," Lillian said. "With the hairy one, that kid that looks like an octopus, all head." "Rafa," Lillian said, then as an afterthought, distracted with worry, "it is time you learned your son's friends' names." "He came by," Rafa did, "and they went off to some bar." Lillian pushed Kaddish's legs off her lap so that he sat up straight, so that she could stand up and face him. "What bar do you think is open tonight? How could you let him leave?" She looked toward the door as if Pato might come through it, and then she asked Kaddish quite calmly, "Don't you have any sense of your own?" "I told him. He doesn't listen." "Then tie him up, hold him down. If your son doesn't listen, why didn't I find you by the door sitting on his back?" "Uncontrollable," Kaddish said. "By his father, uncontrollable. Rebellious Jewish boys only listen to their mothers. For fathers, they have no use." Thanks.
I was just saying to Nathan before we came up here that there's something effectively resigned in the way he reads that chapter, as if he shared sort of the resignation or the fatalism of people caught in a political situation that sort of takes place almost as if like it's the weather. Two things struck me about that reading. One was the Dodge truck, the name of the Dodge truck in the, I think, where the machine gunners are. And similarly, the seemingly detached arm of Kaddish as he's sitting in the chair watching television. I just wonder how in your stories, but much more in your novel, there are what seem to be almost accidental details like that, that give great richness and texture. And I just wonder how conscious you are as you're writing of putting those things in.
Hyper conscious. Yeah. It's really, I guess, it's the line between obsession and madness, I guess. You know, people say, when's a book done? And I say, you know, when, like the NRA, when they can pry it out of my cold, dead hands, you know. But I think that idea, it's almost, I think writers always weave themselves in. I love The Plague. It's one of my favorite books. And there's this guy throughout the book that they go to visit the doctor, and he's working on one sentence the whole book, like the horse trotted down the flowery road, and I said, like, it's sort of that idea where you could spend your life on a sentence, but yeah, I think it needs to read like an unbroken dream or a books of failure. It needs to, but you become conscious of everything. I don't know. It's sort of a creepy, I guess when I talk to writer friends about it, they all hold their hands funny, and I just did that. But it's like, sometimes You know, it sometimes happens when I'm at live music where you, like, I'll be writing and you can hear the language and you can see the scene and you can see the room, but you're inside everybody's head. It's like this multi-dimensional. But yeah, I am hyper aware of those things. In a sense, that Dodge thing is one of three references to America, you know, who we're doing business with. You know, that's very much not an accident. But you don't want to overdo, you know, Orwell's so hyper-political because that's who he is. Like, if I would introduce that stuff into a book, it would corrupt. You can only be yourself to the extreme. So,
well, that must mean, especially considering the way you introduced the reading, that must mean that one of my main questions to you was, how political a writer do you consider yourself to be? And so when you made the introduction, that amped up the reason for asking.
Yeah, but that's a reverse. That was actually a things test. I think it's a moral act, writing. I really do, but not, you know, you can be immoral as a person, you know, writer, like you can eat a bowl of babies for breakfast and go around killing hobos. Like, I think that's not what, but there, it's weight, a system of weights and measures, and your obligation as a writer, I think, is a moral thing to the work and then within in the work. So it's not, I only became political because I would have been a horrible person. After, I hate making political. I'm nervous. I listen to every. If you told me my name's not Nathan right now, I wouldn't say it is Nathan. I would consider first. But to spend, to dedicate like 10 years of my life to the idea that, like, because you get into. I didn't care if this book has a lot of plastic surgery in it. I could care less before and I could care less now. I cared when I was writing it, but then I gave up with that. You know, I just went to see my friend's eyes. She's getting them done. I was like, show me what, the, you know, I don't care. But the habeas corpus thing, I spent so many years imagining. I thought it would just be immoral if I actually didn't have a stand, it just even in my head, but it became personal to me.
I mean, the Dodge truck does stand for America. One of the reasons it does so well is that there's not much more. It sort of stands out in its tininess.
But it's about building a world, and the world needs however much politics. In a sense, I had to unweave this book. You know, when you're reading, I got rid of my, I was going to say, I can't usually say I read enormous amounts, but I finally got rid of my TV. It's like a drug, having a TV. I read like 76 books. At the bookstore, they're like, now they're not, I come in every single day and buy another stack. But the point is, while I was reading for this novel, the novel's reading at the time, it's, there's such a danger when people fall in love. You can't fall in love with your facts. You know, sometimes I read a novel and it's going swimmingly, and then I can feel like, oh God, you know, he just loved this topographical map and he couldn't control himself. But the point is, this book is about two Argentines, you know, the mother and the father, and then, you know, searching for the son. But it was that idea where I wrote it and it was filled with facts, and I had to unweave, because I think about it like a New Yorker. The example I use is, if you're writing a book about New York from Toronto or something, you'd say, like, he came up the ramp, you know, from the subway, and he walked down 42nd Street and took the four steps up to the New York Public Library, where there were 22 tables that had holes for umbrellas, but no umbrellas, and the chairs were chained to their legs, you know, and in the summer, that's not, you know, if you're in New York, you say, I'll see you at the Lions, because that's it. Right. You know which entrance it is. And that's it. And for me, it was stripping this book, not describing Buenos Aires that way, and undoing all my facts, because I needed to see, like, this is what Lillian sees. You know, when we said our neighborhood talk, you walk down the street 30,000 times, you know, it's different what you see.
But that raises the question for me, since you obviously immersed yourself in Argentinian history, at least of that time, and I dare say before and after, how much research you did, how you used it, and whether you then tried to strip it away while you were writing your novel.
Yeah, it's, it's funny, having been raised religious, I always have to reference every point where it came. There's this concept of Gezel Das, dot, theft of knowledge. So anything like discussed at the table, I have to be like, we discussed that at the table. We'll talk about what I'm up to now, but I feel like I owe my first grown-up story, which I got the idea for when I was 19 and started my early 20s and wrote it again and again for the next 5 years, which is The 27th Man, about these four writers in a cell. But it wouldn't have happened if I was a little younger or something. Like, there was a Soviet Union. Like, we didn't know this stuff. We didn't know anything about it. And I was, it's about, you know, all the end of the Yiddish writers killed under Stalin. And I heard this story as, you know, I thought a writer should write them a story. I said, my God, the greatest writers died with their greatest story of their lives to tell someone. And for years, I dreamed of being a writer and said someone should write them this story, and no one did. So, but I wrote it. But the point is, I didn't have any facts. There just weren't, you know, there wasn't anything. So I had to dream it all. And that sort of shaped things for me about greater truths in a sense. Like, I just think for the idea of this book, people say, how do you do 1976 Argentina? I'm not married. I'm not a woman. I don't have a kid. The biggest challenge in this book for me is to draw a mother of a missing son. And so I do all my writing first. I do very little research and I write it because that's what needs to be true, or the fear of a government needs to be true. I write the whole world and finish it. And then I do an obsessive amount of research.
So the veneer of factuality, I mean in a good sense, the stain of factuality comes after you make the furniture.
Yeah, because you know what? This is so touchy-feely, and it's, I've been on the road. Again, the book's, it's almost 2 years, and I've been basically on the road, you know. You're like, why aren't you more famous? Good question.
You're pretty famous.
But it's just this idea of being intimate, like learning to, you know, it's to tell you the truth. It's like, it's something my mother deeply believes. It's like, I think the only compliment you want as a writer, like, if you're going to believe good reviews, then you have to believe bad reviews. You know, it's like, if you're going to believe that people say you look young in your jacket, then somebody's going to say something nasty before the night's over. You know, like, but the one thing that I care about, I just want people, to me, it matters for people to say, how did you know? Whether it's, you know, for Argentine, if an Argentine of that time can't read this book and tell me, you know, how did you know, or that's right, then there's a problem. So for me, I often think it's the touchy-feely part I'm sort of sliding around. I think if you dream things enough, that you'll dream them true. Like, I really think you can pick someone in the audience and say, I'm going to write your life, sir, and I should go away, and if I work hard enough and write hard enough, I'll get the summer camp. You know, you'll tell me, actually, I was in bunk 6, not bunk 5. But so I really think if you spend enough time carefully thinking about people in a situation, that oddly the big stuff will match. And then, and the other thing, I mean, I'm a workshopper, which has its, I went to Iowa when I was studying and it really shaped my study with Maron Robinson, who I love so dearly, who would, you know, you would just have a glass on the table and you'd have it sweating and she'd be like, actually, you said they were on the second floor and it was March and barometric pressure and there were 4 ice cubes, a glass would not sweat in those conditions. And you'd be like, oh, you know, I read in this obsessive manner, but I think the things a novel needs then are true. Like this whole book, the book is called The Ministry of Special Cases. That I made up, and that's true because it's a necessity. So I'm sort of off in a million places. I'll end this question, but it's just that idea that anything that the book needs is true by virtue of its necessity, and then anything else is a horrible error.
And then it often turns out to be close to the case in real life.
And
must have been some sort of bureaucratic nightmare.
Well, only when I was reading in Jerusalem, which is funny, where they'll come up to me and they'll be like, this is our interior ministry. People say to me, how did you dream up this horror, this hell? And I said, like, try and get a parking permit in Jerusalem, you know, where you walk in, they throw your papers in the garbage. They, you know, so only Israelis know what it's really based on, is just trying to do anything at the interior ministry. But like little thing, I had Kaddish for years. I had him kicking a can down the street in chapter 2 of the book for years and years. The point is, they didn't have canned soda in Argentina till, you know, after the coup.
Right.
It was a bottle. And those are the kind of facts that I hunt, you know.
It reads that way, but it doesn't. I mean, the great achievement is that it doesn't read heavily that way. It doesn't read like a weather report. I'm curious about...
That's a good blurb.
I'm curious about the title story, which you've mentioned, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, because... there's a kinship in all your writing, but I think there's a big distinction between the stories and the novel. Not only are the stories in the novel, but the structure and shape of them, it's the same writer, it's the same verbal ability, it's the same care with detail, but the stories, just like the sighting of the Dodge truck, the novel feels almost like a living accident. In a way, it's almost as if it takes the writer as much by surprise as it does the reader, because these events are full, just as the chapter you read, these events are unfolding in a sort of meteorological way. In the stories, on the other hand, there are situations, so to speak. Did you feel when you started to write your first novel that it took a big adjustment for you to get used to a different narrative aesthetic?
No, that's a super generous way to ask that question. I appreciate it. Like that, it was a huge, yeah, I say they're just different. I feel like it's like I had a, you know, and again, you can only be you in this situation. It's me who, like, I had to experience, everything went nice with the story. It was very overwhelming what came with all that. The point is, I feel like I had a really successful gallery show and I had these paintings, and then I'm an industrial sculptor. Like, you have maybe an aesthetic, and you know, but it's totally, a novel is not linked stories at all. And I thought about it for a long time. I didn't want a novel that didn't need to be a novel. And for me, it's, you know, back to, we can talk about Passover too, but the idea of Dayenu, it would suffice, it would be enough. You know, but this idea, I wanted a story that would build, you know, my main character is a man who is a son of a whore, and he works in a whore cemetery chipping off the names, like each level, you know, it needs to build, and then this, and then Argentina, and until I had a story that to me built in that way. I call it executing the unexecutable, like some stories I heard, you know, one Gilgul in that book, I heard two people talking at a table and I wrote it. Sometimes you see the idea or whatever. This, the book hinges on an action that when I thought of it, the end of the book, I said, this will be impossible. It will never, it is unjustifiable to create a realistic situation where someone makes this set of choices where this person, for those who haven't read it, you know, climbs over the wall, let's say. And that took me 10 years of like reverse engineering. So yeah, a story is, I love the form, the short story. It's a spring-loaded, it's a pressurized, frozen, this moment in time, and you can hold the whole story in your head in a very different manner. Yeah, it was a full-on education again to write a novel. I felt like I was starting again.
Many people say that short stories are much closer to poetry than they are to novels, and I think the reason is that they're spatial, whereas a novel automatically has some linear, it has to develop. In many of your stories and in the novel, there is a common denominator, and I talked about being...
Jews?
Yeah, are you... that's one of the main questions. Are you Jewish?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. God, I wasn't sure. I mean, you know, you're a fiction writer. You may have made it all up. How aware are you in both the stories, including there's the Gilgul, which I think is about the man who converts, because God tells him he's a Jew, and his wife is freaked.
Yeah.
And then the next story, there's Kringle. I think it's the very next story.
Yeah.
Did you realize that you had a Christian becoming a Jew, and then a Jew in the next story?
No, I did not.
Dressing up as a Christian.
Yeah.
It's about a Jewish guy who plays Santa Claus in a department store. And
Do you know how many Jews? It's funny, you write these things, and anything you dream, I have met so many Jewish and religious and real bearded Santas along going around America. I've met every Jewish Santa in America.
Yeah. Well, right, and right, there should be a reading club of Jewish Santa just for you. How much do you think about the plights? In many of your stories are extreme. They're either personally extreme or politically, like the Stalinist Russia rounding up these writers. It's life and death, and mainly death. The coup in Argentina results in awful consequences for the family and for many other people as well. How much do you think these stories and these narratives, how much of in your mind are they in some way intensified representations of, excuse the expression, existential plights? Please.
Yeah, I guess it's just what... I'm so not aware when I'm doing it. You know, I'm really interested in... I'm in it, I guess. That's when I learned to just do my work. It was back in workshop. I'd show friends a story that I think was hysterical, and they'd be like, I cried, but it's working. I'd be like, fine. And then I think it was, you know, vice versa sad, and they'd be like, it's hysterical. I'm just not really aware of the bigger elements. I guess in the book, I'm interested in those boundaries. I it's things that I'm thankful for my religious upbringing for. I was raised with story, and I was raised with these kind of large stories, and I was taught them not as story, but as truth. And I guess that's what interests me is, you know, I can split the two books. You know, yeah, it's easy to say they're just Jews and more Jews, but it's like the first book for me was about, again, that pressure was about crossing boundaries. I was religious, then I was secular, and I was obsessed with stories about people crossing boundaries and how you get to the other side. And then, you know, this novel, I was living in Israel, and I'd lived so many different facets of Jewish experience. But I was sort of shocked, you know, back to this idea to see, you know, again, for me, you know, to be like charmed by the inauguration, be like, oh, I connect with this president. But to feel this, living in Israel was the first time I understood that government was run by people, which was a horrifying discovery. It was. You know, I had this balcony. This book is my balcony because I just looked out. I saw the Knesset, you know, the parliament and the Beit Mishpat Elyon, Supreme Court, you know, these buildings were right there. And, you know, it's not, you know, Bibi Netanyahu, may he not be prime minister again. Let's have a look in two countries. But, you know, like he'd come work out at the Hilton. That was the gym. We all worked, you know, like George Bush has his own treadmill. And it was this idea of, I guess, I started to understand community, you know, a fam. That's why the story builds. You know, 15 to 30,000 people were disappeared in the dirty war. It's so shocking to me that now, a quarter century later, give or take 100%. Can you imagine if we talked about the Holocaust? It was 3 or 6 million. We're not, you know, like it's, we don't even know all this time later. And I started to think, you know, you can't tell every story. That's what fiction is for. You know, history is one thing. Fiction is one mother, one father, one son. I said, that's a community. And then another community is, you know, your neighbors and then society. And in Israel, it was the first time I understood, oh my God, these people are responsible for me. To answer, first book was breaking through boundaries, and the second one, I was just really interested on what's on this side of the wall. And when I was having dinner with this old man, who I'm sure is a spy, when everyone walks around saying they're a spy, those are the people that are not spies. It's the people who just talk about food. Burma, delicious pancakes. Guy, you know, but he was in Argentina. Wonderful steak, is what he said. But he was everywhere, wherever weapons were coming from. You know, anyway, but he had told me about this, you know, a cemetery. That was when I understood this side of the wall, which is these Jews, these women, you know, we're in America, we're obsessed with prostitutes in a weird way, you know, with this pretty woman idea that you know, whether that's a dream for you, but to be with Richard Gere and eat caviar and a nice, it's always a nice, these are turn of the century women selling their bodies to survive. You know, they would have died in the Shoah. They would have died at the spindle. This was to save their lives. They had to sell themselves to foreign workers in these horrible brothels. And they were religious women who wanted to go to shul and wanted to be buried as Jews, and that the community, you know, Argentina's a middle class, they wanted to move up and not move down, and there was plenty of anti-Semitism. But what, you know, when I heard that they had this cemetery and they said to these women, we will not be buried with you, and they put up a wall and they bury the pimps and the whores on the other side. And I thought, for one Jew to face another and say, I will not be, like, who the fuck are you? You know, to me, it was the ultimate failure of community in the extreme. And that, in a sense, you know, living in Jerusalem at this time where, you know, I can't even talk about after this week of Gaza, like the endless madness. I'm turning back into American Jew here. When at first this invasion, I was like, oh, maybe this is just, it's not justified on either side. When Hamas would blow up a bus in Jerusalem to help the Palestinians, they were murdering their own. And when Israel would drop a one-ton bomb on Gaza, they were killing us. I stopped caring. Who cares about the politics? You drop that bomb on Gaza, you're blowing up my coffee shop when I'm in it or when I'm not. It's murder of your own. And that mix of watching people decide when we're going to die and who's going to die, and this idea of community judging each other, it all sort of switched.
They're all in the novel. I mean, they're all in the novel. The decision on the part of to the characters, an invisible, not known government, and then also the intense conflict between two sort of sets of Jews who should probably have been two sets of Jews. Let me say, one more question before we take questions from the audience. Let's go back to the title story. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I want to ask you how you write. I want to ask you all those sort of freshman mixer questions.
Yes, exactly.
I was saying before, what's your favorite color? And, you know, what are you majoring in?
Exactly. Aquarius.
Do you want to dance? And stuff like that. But there is I want to go back to the title story, to the first story in For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, in which Soviet era Jewish writers have been rounded up. I think, how many, 26 or 27? They're kept in cells for each, and they are about to meet their fate. I couldn't help reading that, because I'm such a sort of like confabulator. I couldn't help reading it as not only being about Jews in Soviet Russia, writers who were seeking some sort of, hoping for some sort of legacy or immortality. I also thought with the light going on and off arbitrarily signaling daytime or nighttime when it didn't make any sense. I felt as if it were somehow a kind of almost Beckett-like summary of the human, of a human condition of some general kind. Did that ever enter your mind? I came all the way over here from Manhattan
exactly.
to ask you that
I have
question.
Not read,
stuck in a situation
but,
in
you
which
know,
forces...
I'm never aware. It's nice. It's like it's very nice to come out and talk to people because then you see everything better be in a book. Like if it's functioning. So, you know, I'd have these people, these communists would come up to me to argue about my position on communism, which I didn't have, you know. But it's like I wrote this novel for 10 years. I knew the habeas corpus part. I knew the community part. I didn't know until I was finished that it's a book about a father and a son. Like I just, it's central to the novel. And I don't have to be aware of that. So in that I see now it was just that story was for me permission to write. And that's all it was.
Okay.
That, yeah.
Let me say that before I turn it over that one of the things in both of these books and particularly in the novel is the way extremely dramatic events happen almost arbitrarily. The way one of the stories is about a guy in a cafe in Israel and there's a bomb explodes and you have this feeling of intense arbitrariness of the intervention of forces beyond your control in your life. And I think that's one of the things that most impresses me. We did get a little bit about your writing process. We know you're obsessive.
Yeah.
We know it takes you 10 years to write a sentence sometimes. And we know you change cans into bottles when it's correct to do so.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's part of it. Questions?
Yes, sir. Yeah, and there's... Did you have that accent before you started reading? No. But this is, you know, this is sort of it where I guess... Thank you for that as a question because that weaves in. It's for me, you know, being raised religious, there's an order to everything. You know, it sort of freaks me out when deeply religious friends have some tragedy, and I'm fascinated by the idea of, like, there, you know, the belief in an order to the world. It's a real, you know, I'm not dismissing it. It's a wonderful thing. And for me, it's that idea of wanting things to be faded in order and seeing the chaos. But I'm talking about Gaza 5 minutes ago. You know, like, when you look at that map, it's because of the crazy British took... Why do you think 18 countries meet at the Red Sea? You can see the ruler. They took a ruler and said, everyone needs port access. And they drew, you know. That's how they did it, you know. And it's causes problems, as you can... You know, so, yeah, I'm obsessed with that idea that it's just, you know... singular people with dreams and, you know, some things work and some things don't, but it's sort of infinite how the pain and suffering, sometimes goodness and sometimes pain from singular dreams and singular acts. It's terrifying to me. But Britain played a pretty good role in plenty of it. Yes. Oh, so they asked about the doctor in the... Not, they read it in their reading group. I have a return policy. Bring your receipts.
You mean the nose doctor?
Yeah, there's a plastic surgeon who's sort of central to the book, and she asked about him as the fourth character. I guess part of it is I'm obsessed with... I'm so going to get arrested giving, like, breast implants in Queens, where they're going to be like, that guy wasn't really a doctor. I knew that was a private apartment. But, like, I'm obsessed with medical stuff. Because it's just that idea of, as an indecisive, nervous person, I like this... I'm obsessed with this job where you make decisions. You know, one of my closest, dearest friends is an intensive care doctor. You know, he's constantly, you know, every day somebody's dead or they save somebody. You know, it's just... I think about that idea, you know, back to this, you know, question of individual roles. But, I'm obsessed with the gray. I want everything to be black and white. And yeah, it was sort of in your question, but he is the gray to me. And this man where he's sort of a, not a sociopath, but, you know, remorseless in many ways. But that doesn't mean you can't be remorseless and have a human side. In a sense, when he's offended, he takes action. And I don't have a good answer for that. Did that sound like an answer? Yeah.
Someone else. By the way, I want the name of that doctor, the real doctor,
because
I have some work to do over here.
You, sir, and then you, ma'am. Yes, sir. Oh, you're nice. Yeah, about bearing witness, about being, even a singular witness if everyone else doesn't see or see something else. I guess I just... There's a reason I think so many of my heroes, just about everybody I love who's ever written, has lived abroad for a period. You don't see... you know, I always talk about even just living my life in Hebrew for all those years where, you know, I always say the example like mechonat kvisa. Like my whole life I heard washing machine and I never thought about it till Hebrew. Ah, it is the machine which washes. That's why it's called a washing machine. You know, like everything breaks down, but I didn't question narratives. You know, I don't question Thanksgiving. The Brady Bunch version is fine with me. And it was that idea to be in a country. Israel's so young and they've got plenty of problems. They have really good journalists and they're really willing to explore the narrative, but watching the national narrative change, the whole time I was there, it was the first time there was tech money and it was this idea of the individual was born. It was the first time people said, I don't want to, Zetov lamut ba'adar tzenu, I thought, which is it is good to die for one's country. And I thought Trumpledore had said this when he was dying after being wounded in Tel Chai. And I had no idea that that Trumpledore had been in the world, you know, brought it from the Brits who'd used it for hundreds of years, and then it comes back from the Romans. You know, I just didn't know that reality is a construct. And I guess I just got really obsessed with this idea that, you know, especially all these years where they're saying there's no global warming, and I was like, if they win, you know, governments don't lie. Lying is what I do. If I say I'll be here at 6 and I come at 7 and I was watching TV, you know, I wanted to see another episode of The Wire or something. And, you know, that's a lie. To try and create reality, to create history, it's a really, you know, that Cheney stuff, it was nefarious, like trying to create a new narrative. And just this idea, I thought, wow, if they convince the whole world there's no global warming, then is there not? Like if every last person agrees that, oh, we're going through a warm patch or this is the natural change of the planet. And I just really wanted to know what truth was. And watching in Israel, like again, the Israelis and the Palestinians, they're not, everyone talks about it like it's a spectrum. They're not differing opinions. There are two realities. I think there's a singular truth is what I've come to believe. Truth exists, but there are multiple realities. And I guess I just really got obsessed with what it is if this one man is stuck and this one woman, if they're the only, because that's what happened in Argentina. Literally, after you write a book, then people come up to you, oh yeah, my cousin, like they wouldn't speak to them. Their kid would disappear. People would cut off relations, a brother from a sister, your coworker, somebody would be dragged out of this room and we would all just pause and then go back on. You know, I just wanted to know how true, it's in the book, how true is anything that only one man believes? It just personally started to obsess me. Yeah, the woman's addressing the nose. Thank you. It's funny because a lot of people treat the nose job chapter as if it's like a funny thing or a weird side thing. But for me, I was very interested in like historicity and of the continuum. You know, we get a individual story. You know, just even that idea where, you know, jokingly at the beginning, well, which bio do I read? Like, it just makes different. There's an individual story, a family story, a national story, a religious story. And I just got interested. I was reading Borges' essays because he's Argentine. And he quotes Pliny. Borges quoting Pliny. I'll stay Talmudic. But, Pliny said, to change a face, it is murder. And I really thought about this idea. You know, if a mother has a nose job and a father has a nose job, a child will not be born with a post-operative nose. I did that sort of P cross thing. But, you know, I just got interested in what it was to change. And then I'll tell you, I've told this very few times or maybe not, but actually growing up, it's one of my mom's friends. They all went to get nose jobs. And one friend got the beautiful nose, which she still has because she had the teacher. They went to get, like you get haircuts, like, oh, we'll go to the training center. But I remember, I must have been 6, it's just my mother's like, you're a weird child. I just remember my mom, you know, I'll change her name, but just holding fun being like, Lori's nose fell off. But she had woken up one morning, the friend and her nose had fallen off. They put it back on. But that stayed in my head. But it was really more that idea of back to dreaming a mother and the mother of a missing son. I thought, I don't have a kid, but I thought you probably get a lot more beautiful the day your kid is born because you look in the mirror and you see that face back. And I thought this woman who got a nose job not thinking about it, but then when her son was gone, to me it was just this sort of, when you talk about existential issues, but like the ultimate horrible moment for her to look in the mirror and see she still would have had her son, but she had actually erased the last of him. She still would have had him. And Argentina, again, is obsessed with plastic surgery. You know, in a way, they beat us a lot earlier and a lot longer. You know, where you're like, what lovely people, and they all have big boobs. You know, like, and then you're like, oh, the whole country's dogs. Everyone has their ears pinned. Everyone. Do we have time for one more or no more? Uno más?
sorry.
Yeah, what am I reading now, and do I get lost in fiction? Yeah, it's funny. I try to be a really bad... I try to love every movie and have no taste in music. I work really hard because you can't become annoying about everything. You know, you can't be like, this coffee, I wanted a medium roast. I think the beans needed another... Got to lower the temperature. You know, how many things can I be obsessive about? So, yeah, it gets weirder to find things that... It's about, I love that idea that it's truth. Like, even translation, there's that thing in Don Quixote, you know, he gets to Barcelona, I guess, and he wants to smash a printing press. They're translating. He's like, the horrors. But I love translation, that most of the books I love are translation, that even the, again, back to truth, that stuff transfer. Like, I just love that idea. Open Gogol anywhere at any time and read it. And from word one, it's just true. You know, it's just, it's so, you can't not believe it. I love it. So yeah, it gets harder and harder when I find something that I like. I hope they have a lot of books. You know, I'd never read Cormac McCarthy for some reason. And, you know, now I've done No Country for Old Men. And you know, that's probably where I started. And then The Road. And then I did Blood Meridian and All the Pretty Horses. I'm in the middle of The Crossing, you know, so.
Have you read The Orchard Keeper? The first one, I think.
I'll get there. But it's just not, yeah, when the rhythm works, I just love it. And I like the idea that I don't understand a word. I was... talking to a friend who worked with him, I was like, what's his regular vocabulary like? But he's a quiet guy, apparently.
I don't know how we are for time, but done, one more question? Yes. Play in the back.
No, super. But that's my experience, and that's a super question to end on, but, you know, sort of, why Argentina, why this, and, you know, why didn't this woman know about it? And I think that's the idea. Obviously, the scope of, you know, I mean, I guess this is it. I was raised from very little, those weird little Holocaust films that they show in Yom HaShoah, which are very strange. I can go on to that for 9 hours. It's sort of like, you know, these little weird tapes, and it's probably the first time you've seen naked people, but they're being pushed into it's a very creepy childhood education to genocide. And anyway, and they play with these weird tapes of the boots clomping. It's anyway, but this idea where I'm from the Jewish Mayflower. You know what I'm saying? Like, people say, where's your family before New York? I say Boston. You know, like, this is, but this idea that I have the same, this Holocaust head, like my friends whose parents are survivors, that was educated into me. And I got really interested into what you're saying, that I was given this, but not the Armenian genocide. Like, why not? Or I'm doing this and I'm, you know, I'll be focused on Gaza, but not, you know, what's going on. You know, people are being hacked to death in a church right now. You know, like, it's, yeah, I met these Argentines. I had, you know, I grew up in the suburbs in a religious bubble, and then I went to State University, which was in Racine, and I met Jews from other parts of Long Island. So for me, when I went to my junior year abroad to go to Israel, that was the first time I met Jews from other countries, which was crazy. But to meet these Argentine guys who were messed up in a very specific way and maybe 2 years older than me, and I thought, like, I can't tell you, if I didn't meet these guys in Jerusalem who became my friends, if I would know about this today. And I thought about this idea that I know about the Holocaust from birth, and it was this thing, and never forget, and never again. And then I thought, the first year I remember is 1976, when they didn't used to make new quarters every day, but it was the bicentennial quarter. I remember that year, and to think, you know, my country was dealing with these people, and in a plumb line, you know, not the other side of the planet, straight down, this was going on, and I never would have heard it. It just amazed me. And yeah, that really sparked it was my not knowing. It was the disappearance of this story. You know, I even thought when I wrote the book, people still don't really care about this story. And it got to obsess me, my not knowing. My disappearance of history is what drove me to it. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Jeremy.
You're being here. I speak, I hope, on behalf of BAM to some extent and the National Book Foundation. I hope you'll come back. I have a couple more of these gigs, and this is a great way to start. I can't imagine it'll get better than this, but it was a great pleasure to talk to you.